It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. There are various treatment options available for people with opioid addiction, but doctors don't always have access to them. There are some medications, for instance, which can't be easily prescribed and must be taken in a clinical setting. And there are mental health and trauma issues that physicians treating pain or addiction might find themselves ill-equipped to address. Dr. Nora Volkov is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health, and she wrote a piece for Scientific American called "How Can We Better Support Physicians in Addressing the Opioid Crisis?" Dr. Volkov, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
So give us a sense of what physicians are up against these days when it comes to the opioid crisis.
Well, they are against a significant number of cases for which they actually have not been properly trained to sometimes even detect, and much less treat. And as a result of that, they find themselves not being able to help their patients. So this is one of the big blocks that we're seeing in the healthcare system, that overall for many, many years, physicians have not recognized that addiction is a disease and that part of their responsibility as physicians is to take care of patients who are suffering from this disease. And now that we have the opioid crisis, this has become an urgent need.
So you write in your piece that a recurring theme that you and other addiction researchers keep seeing is this treatment gap. So talk to me more deeply about what this treatment gap is.
Well, in addition to the fact that physicians are not properly trained, there are also impediments in the structure and reimbursement practices of paying for services rendered to individuals suffering from an opioid use disorder. And so the medications that we currently have for treating opioid addiction, which are actually very effective, are not necessarily reimbursed in all conditions. And two, some of these reimbursement plans only allow for one medication but not for the other. And the result is that basically less than 30% of patients that could benefit from these medications are given access to them. And then when they are giving access to them, they are not given access to them for sufficiently enough time to allow them to recover. So that's where we see an enormous gap in terms of numbers of patients that could benefit from these medications, but also in terms of the quality of care that the patient should be given when given these medications and the support systems that are necessary for them to recover.
So do you think that this is a systemic thing, that we need to change the way we approve and pay for medications and treatments?
Absolutely, definitely. Because if you do not get proper reimbursement, then it's much less likely that a patient will get access to the medications. And two, there's no other disease for which basically the insurance says, well, I'm only going to offer you one type of intervention. So if you have a depression, it's not that the physician is going to be reimbursed for just one specific antidepressant or one specific antibiotic. Mm. But in this case, yes. And it's also a situation where we have three different medications, and one of them, methadone, cannot be provided by a physician. It has to be dispensed basically on a methadone clinic. So we have many barriers when it comes to treating individuals suffering from an opioid use disorder.
We've heard a lot about methadone, which doesn't allow people to take the medication on their own time, which may make them not take the medication at all. But many listeners are familiar with a new drug called Narcan. Talk to me about what that's about.
Narcan is actually an old medication that has been used specifically for reversing an overdose. It's an opioid antagonist. So it binds to the receptor that normally would be bound by OxyContin or heroin or morphine, but it displaces it. And an overdose occurs when opioids like heroin or morphine bind to the receptors in the respiratory centers in the brain, inhibiting their function. And what Narcan does is it pushes those drugs out, allowing you to breathe again, allowing those cells in the respiratory center to become active. And that's why it's such an effective medication to prevent someone from dying, because they stop breathing. The issue and the challenge has been to provide this medication very rapidly and at a dose sufficiently high to properly displace the opioids so you can breathe. And what has been new about Narcan was a development of a formulation that allows you to give the medication by inhalation as opposed to injection. That was the innovation behind the new nasal Narcan. And the beauty of it is it's an easy to use. It's user-friendly, what I like to call user-friendly, because you don't need to be trained on how to inject in order to save a life. And any one of us, with or without training, can properly deliver nasal Narcan, and if you do it on time, you can save a life.
And physicians can do this, but that, because the antagonist is a class that they can prescribe, but the other class, which methadone falls into, why can't they prescribe that?
The other medication, they can. There's another medication. There are two other medications. One of them is buprenorphine, which goes by the name of Suboxone. And the other one is naltrexone, which is also an antagonist but very long-lasting and can be used for treatment of opioid addiction. And the extended release formulation, which lasts 1 month, goes by the name of Vivitrol. Buprenorphine, Suboxone, can only be prescribed by physicians that are given, actually go through a training of 8 hours. That's what it's necessary for them to prescribe it. And there are not many physicians that have gone to that training, and this then limits the number of providers that can give this medication, which actually significantly improve the outcomes and also has been shown to prevent overdoses.
We've Zachary from tweeted to us this morning. He says medication-assisted treatment is an important tool with both legal and logistical barriers for docs, but perhaps more importantly, we need wraparound counseling options available for patients 24/7, especially in rural places. Talk to me about how mental health and drug addiction counseling plays into this.
Well, it is clear that in one of the most challenging aspects of treating addiction in general, and certainly opioid addiction, is the associated comorbidity that goes with it. Because when you become addicted, you start to withdraw from your surroundings, you become more isolated, and the drug itself, the opioid, the going up and down, basically makes you vulnerable to depression, anxiety, irritability. And you add that the withdrawal symptoms that emerge when the drug starts to leave your system, that can be an extremely uncomfortable situation. So it is actually quite frequent to see patients that are addicted to opioids to suffer from depression. And one of the aspects that even makes the whole issue of the addiction worse and the crisis is the high comorbidity sometimes with suicidal thinking. So individuals that become addicted to opioids start to lose their will to live, and that, of course, puts them at very, very high risk of dying and not making it. So when we're treating someone, we need to recognize that we are going to have to take care also of these associated mental comorbidities, this distress. Because if you don't do it, the likelihood of the person to sustain their recovery treatment is much harder.
We have to take care of the whole person. Dr. Nora Volkoff is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. Her recent piece for Scientific American is called "How Can We Better Support Physicians in Addressing the Opioid Crisis?" Dr. Volkoff, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to look at stray voltage, what it is, and why farmers are afraid of it. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Lawyers for dairy farmers and some banks are asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to take up the issue of a farmer whose cows were made sick by stray voltage. What, you may ask, is stray voltage? Well, we got the guy who knows all the answers. Doug Reinemann is a professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a member of the Midwest Rural Energy Council, and he has been studying and working on stray voltage for a couple of decades now, almost three decades, you just told me, Doug. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. Nice to be here.
So let's lay the groundwork here. What is stray voltage?
Well, stray voltage is a very low-level voltage that occurs on any piece of electrical equipment that's grounded. So first of all, we ground electrical equipment for reasons of safety. So there's a naturally occurring voltage. Whenever we ground a piece of electrical equipment, there's always some voltage there. And it's typically a very low level. If the installation is done correctly, it's a very low level. It's not problematic. There are some electrical faults that can cause that voltage to be elevated, and it can become problematic when it reaches certain levels.
Electrical faults. Talk to me about that.
Right. So the voltage that we're talking about is developed on something called the neutral system. So if you look at the plug on your wall, mm-hmm. there's two, there's three, right?
Right.
So there's a live, one of those slots in the plug is 110 volts. One of those is a ground and one of those is a neutral. So the neutral has a very low voltage on it. So the faults typically are in the neutral system. And so typically it's a bad connection, possibly an undersized wire for the load. But I would say most typically something is not connected correctly, mm-hmm. or a connection has been made that has become corroded or damaged over time.
If we're talking about a farm, this is on the ground. Is this the same thing as a magnetic field?
No, it's very different from magnetic field. So when we talk about stray voltage, the technical definition is it's something that's carried on wires. So kind of remember, it's developed on the neutral wire. So stray voltage is developed on the neutral wire. And because the grounds and neutral are connected, animals come into contact with it when they touch grounded electrical devices.
And in our homes, the ground and the neutral aren't necessarily connected. They are on two different prongs.
Well, when at the plug, at the point of use, they are separate, but both in the farm and at the home, there is an interconnection between the ground and neutral back at the service entrance panel. And that is required by electrical codes, and it's required for safety reasons.
Okay, so you're telling me that this is out there. I'm wondering, we're talking about cows getting zapped, essentially, but does this pose a risk for humans?
Not normally. So first of all, stray voltage, the levels when we talk about stray voltage are not levels that are lethal, so that's not an electrocution hazard. It's more of just an annoyance in the levels we're talking about for stray voltage. So it's not something that can kill a person or a cow through electrocution. The levels are much, much lower than that. The example I really like that's most illustrative, if you take a 9-volt battery and you stick it on your tongue, if you've ever done that, right? So remember, that's 9 volts,
right?
And you put it on your tongue and you feel something,
right?
But it doesn't cause you to, you know, it doesn't cause electrocution. It's much too low for that. And it's you know, it can be, you definitely know it's there. It can be annoying, but it's not lethal.
But if every time I go to get a drink of water, there's that 9-volt jolt on my tongue, I'm going to be like, I don't really want to take that water anymore. And that is exactly what we're talking about.
Exactly.
Here, right?
So cows can change their drinking behavior. And that's one of the most common symptoms of stray voltage, is that cows will change their drinking behavior. Typically, they'll go longer between drinks. And in extreme cases, their water consumption might be suppressed if that voltage is occurring at their only water source.
We want to hear from you on this. Have you ever heard of stray voltage? What questions do you have about this grounded current that can cause small electrical shocks when it makes contacts with humans and animals? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So There is a conception out there that stray voltage comes from utilities in the area. And in fact, this lawsuit, which we'll be talking about later, sued a utility company that was found to have not properly set up its grounding materials. So are utilities generally the source of this?
So I have to sort of back up just a little bit and say that Wisconsin was really the first state in the nation to address the stray voltage issue. And the state of Wisconsin, through the Department of Ag, the Public Service Commission, and the university, have been working very hard at this issue for over 30 years. So back when we started on this, one of the first things that was done was to develop a test protocol. So it's really important to test stray voltage correctly. And the test protocol, and there's also rules and regulations in Wisconsin that apply to utility companies. So the Public Service Commission, we were the first state in the nation to actually establish a stray voltage rule. And that rule recognizes that the source can be the utility, but it also can be on farm. So in the early days, we found, you know, actually slightly more than half of the sources were on farm sources, mm-hmm. slightly less than utilities. Through the years, that ratio has shifted a little bit, so we find fewer utility sources than we used to.
On-farm sources, like a farmer may have a generator on his or her property or a windmill or something like that.
Well, remember that the voltage is developed on the neutral wire, so it's really independent of what the source of the electricity is, whether it's a generator or a windmill or the electricity coming from the utility company. If a neutral wire on the farm is damaged, that's an on-farm source of stray voltage.
And utility companies have more money to fix these kinds of things. Farmers don't necessarily have that kind of money.
Well, so that gets into a very complicated situation. So the utility company is responsible for its equipment and its lines. Once you cross the meter onto the farm, that's farm equipment. Mm. See, the utility really has no authority or responsibility to fix the farmer's wiring. That's the farmer's responsibility.
So farmers do worry about this. I've been told that it is that dairy farmers in particular are very afraid of this because of the potential harm to their cattle. What can it do to them?
Well, so the effects, as mentioned a little bit earlier, they're all behaviorally mediated. So a cow is going to change its behavior in some way. And the way that behavior is changed depends on where the voltage is, when it occurs, how often it occurs. So the place where we tend to spend the most time and energy looking at is watering devices. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The watering device, water systems are typically part of the grounded system on the farm. So they're part of that grounded metallic devices that can be carrier of the voltage. And secondly, it's a wet location. And, you know, we have special rules and regulations for residential wiring in wet locations because the resistance values there are lower and the risk is a bit higher. And then thirdly, it's an important behavioral part of being a dairy cow. You want the cows to drink. And so we're looking for particular behavioral changes that might be related to voltage on watering devices.
You're finding that some cows are more sensitive to the current than others. Why is that?
Part of that has to do with just the body mass of the cow, bigger cow, smaller cow.
Right.
And then part of it has to do with just the sensitivity of the nervous system. And it's very, very similar in people. People have a range of sensitivities to voltage and current exposures, just like cows do.
So bigger cows are not going to be affected as much by that 9-volt battery as smaller cows and humans who are smaller.
Correct.
We are talking about stray voltage with Doug Reinemann, who is an agricultural professor at UW-Madison. Are you a farmer or a rancher? Are you concerned about stray voltage, or do you think this worry is overblown? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So what I want to know is, I put that 9-volt battery in my mouth, and then I take it out, and then I'm fine. If I keep putting it in my mouth am I going to have something, am I going to cause something wrong with me, or is this just kind of an annoyance each time it happens?
Yeah, so I want to put that 9 volts in perspective. So first of all, the rule in Wisconsin is we keep stray voltage exposures below 1 volt.
Okay, so
that's
that good.
9 volt battery is 9 times higher than the level we've established in Wisconsin. So at 1 volt, you would not feel it, and nothing would happen.
Okay.
At 9 volts, well, I'll just say what cows do. What people do is, I haven't studied that in particular, but I think there's a similarity, right? So the first time the cow is exposed, you see the most dramatic response. And then typically, as with repeated exposures, the cow's response becomes less severe. And, you know, most cows adapt to it in some way.
We are talking about stray voltage this morning, how it affects mostly cattle, but also other animals, and what it is, if it is dangerous and has long-term effects. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. One of the ways to condition an animal to avoid certain situations or objects is to give them an electric shock. This is the theory behind the electric fence that people have in their yards. Cows will also react to the stimulus of stray voltage, which results when the insulation fails in a neutral ground in electrical lines, mostly on dairy farms. But how much does this electric shock actually hurt the cows? And does it last permanently? Are you a farmer or a rancher? Are you concerned about stray voltage? Or do you think the worry is overblown? Have you noticed behavior changes in your cows that you suspect is tied to electric current? What measures do you take to ensure that they don't have stray voltage? 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are sitting here in studio with Doug Reinemann. He is a professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He has done research on the effects of electrical exposure on cows for about 28 years, he tells me. We have Clarence from Watertown who has a question for you, Doug. Clarence, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good morning. Professor, when we worked with Extension on our stray voltage in the stanchion barn, we were told we wanted to get it down below 0.5 volt.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So the way that the stray voltage rule is written in Wisconsin is that the level of concern is 1 volt, and recognizing that there's some on-farm and utility or off-farm source, the Public Service Commission sort of split that and said the utility can provide no more than 0.5 volt, and the farm should also provide no more than 0.5 volt, so that the total is less than 1 volt. So that's where the 0.5 volt comes in. You know, sort of each, both the utility and the farm are sort of, recommended to stay below that 0.5 volt level so that the total is below 1 volt.
So I want to follow up on that. What's the maximum a cow can take without really being hurt?
Well, that's cow dependent. So that 1 volt level was set there because at that level, basically, it's going to cause harm to no cows. So as you go above 1 volt, actually, you really have to get above sort of 2 volts to really start affecting the most sensitive cows. Mm-hmm. And then as you go above 2 volts, you know, at about 5 or 6 volts, about half the cows would be affected in some way. Again, sort of behaviorally changed. And then if you get up into about, 10 or 15 volts, then virtually all cows would be affected.
And once the cows are affected, like, let's talk about this happens through water when they're drinking, but they actually have to come in contact with something, right? So how does that work?
Yeah, so again, the test procedure, what we're doing when we're doing a stray voltage test is we're looking for places on the farm where a cow could come into contact with this voltage. And water is one place we spend a lot of attention because they're very important both electrically and in the life of the cow. There are also other places where a cow could come into contact with voltage. And so in the case of a waterer, there would have to be a voltage potential between that watering device and the floor. So the cow's hooves are on the floor and the cow's muzzle is in the watering device. So that's the point of contact, is from, we call it muzzle to hoof. So when the cow puts the muzzle in the, particularly if the waterer is metallic or it's got an electrical heater in it, you know, that's one point of contact. The other point of contact is the floor.
So make sure that the floor is not wet.
Well, that's, you know, that's one of the reasons we pay attention to water, is because the floor typically is wet,
right,
and that lowers the resistance. It's very similar to the electrical codes that we use in residences, like in bathrooms, where people can be standing on wet floors. We take more care there because that wet surface reduces the contact resistance.
We are talking about stray voltage today, and we're taking your calls. Do you have questions for Doug Reinemann about stray voltage and how it may affect your cattle? Or do you just have questions because you think this is a fascinating topic? 800-642-1234. When a cow is shocked by stray voltage, they may avoid that watering trough. They may then have behaviors that cause them to have less milk because they're not getting enough liquid and things like that. But is this a permanent condition?
No, it's not. So, you know, we've done a number of experiments over the years. And so one of the things that we typically do when we do an experiment is we have a period where we're just observing the cows without any voltage exposure. And then we'll have a period when the voltage exposure is there, and the voltage exposure is a prescribed level, a certain amount of voltage or current. And then we turn it off and watch the cows after that exposure. So what we find is that, first of all, during that exposure period, every cow we've ever studied, and other researchers as well, and I'll just say that there's been about 60 or so researchers around the world who have looked into this and found the same result. Cows adapt. So on the first day of exposure, that behavioral response would be the most severe. And over time, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 days, the cows kind of figure out how to deal with it. When you turn it off, the recovery is almost immediate. So within a matter of hours, once the cows realize that there's no longer voltage on that watering device, their behavior returns to normal very quickly.
And why does it happen so quickly? I mean, it would seem to me that there's kind of a learning behavior there, right? If I touch a hot stove and my hand burns, I will never touch a hot stove again. But the cows don't realize that.
Well, they do, and I guess that sort of points to the level that, you know, if you have voltage levels, let's just say you've got 4 volts, right? So there's a certain percentage of cows that would be able to feel that. That's not like touching a hot stove. It's not burning the cow. Mm. It's not a, you know.
It's just kind of an annoyance.
It's an annoyance. I mean, I would say it's sort of on par with being bit by a fly or something like that, right? So it's not a traumatic experience. And so what cows do is they kind of, you know, they'll come back around. If a cow gets a shock that's annoying, they'll typically back off. And then about an hour later, they kind of come back and try it again. And if it's still there, they sort of learn, but they sort of keep testing. And if the voltage is gone, they very quickly figure that out and resume their normal behavior.
So sort of like, I still go outside even though I get bit by mosquitoes.
That's a interesting, reasonable analogy, yes,
okay.
Yeah.
We're talking about cows here. Have there ever been other animals? And why aren't farmers affected by stray voltage?
Well, the main reason... Well,
I mean, we're smaller than our cows.
Yeah, so let me take the farmer one first. So the main reason that people can't feel voltage, let's just say you've got 4 volts, right? And a cow would be able to feel that, but a person wouldn't. The main reason is that cows are standing barefoot on a wet floor. And typically a person has got rubber boots on and, you know, they've got dry hands and you know, so might even be wearing gloves. So our resistance is much higher than a cow's. So while it takes more current to affect a cow, it takes more voltage to affect a person because our resistance is lower.
So if we want to test this, would it be a good idea if we're like suspect that our, that cows have stray voltage, are dealing with stray voltage issues? Should we just take our shoes off and see if we feel it ourselves, or is that dangerous?
Well, it's typically not dangerous, but it's not a very quantitative test. So, you know, again, in Wisconsin, we have a very well-developed test protocol to figure out what the levels are, and more importantly, what is the source of the voltage. So if anyone has any concerns about stray voltage, the first thing to do is to call their electric power supplier. They'll come out and do a test. So every electric utility, every electric co-op in Wisconsin will come out and do a test on your farm and figure out what the voltage levels are, first of all. And second of all, they'll figure out what the source of that voltage is, so that it can be addressed if it's above problematic levels.
We are talking to agriculture professor and stray voltage expert, Doug Reinemann. We're exploring the phenomenon of stray voltage, what it is, and what farmers can do about it. 800-642-1234. Taking your questions here, you've trained investigators.
Yes.
You've trained the people who go out to the farms to figure out what to do about it. How often should these levels be tested?
Well, I think, you know, I think if you have a concern, then get it tested.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other good practice is if you make any sort of major electrical changes on your farm, it's a good idea to have a test done. You know, if you're installing new electrical equipment, it's a good idea to, you know, just get a test done and make sure everything was put in correctly. Certainly, if you have an addition to a building or any major electrical changes. And then, you know, some farms just do it periodically, maybe, you know, once a year or every couple of years. And again, your electric service provider in Wisconsin will come out and do that test for you.
So we are talking about stray voltage here. You are part of the Midwest Rural Energy Council.
Yes.
Tell me what that is.
Yeah, so this is an organization. It was actually started back after the Second World War, when farms were becoming electrified, the Rural Electric Administration.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, virtually every state had an extension program that was designed to help farms with this process of using electricity on their farm. So this actually dates back to the 1940s. And it used to be called the Wisconsin Farm Electric Council, and it's an extension program. And in the 1990s, we actually merged with utilities and universities in Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota. So it's an organization that's been around a very long time to provide educational resources for particularly electrical energy use on farms.
We are talking to Doug Reinemann. He is an agricultural professor and an expert on stray voltage. We're talking about stray voltage on farms, how it affects farm animals, particularly cows, and what farmers and ranchers can do about it. Take in your calls here, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to come back in a moment and talk about why people not on farms should care about stray voltage. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're exploring the idea of stray voltage this morning. A court case found fault with Northern States Power Company. That may be taken up by the Supreme Court now. But what does stray voltage come from? Does it come from power companies? Does it come from farms? Are you someone who lives in a rural area, and do you avoid land near power sources due to fear of stray voltage? 1-800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is where you can email us, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are sitting here with Doug Reinemann. He's a professor of agriculture and life sciences at UW-Madison, and he has advised the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin on animal response levels and investigated methods for the stray voltage rules that have been in place in Wisconsin since the early 1990s. So, Doug, one of the things that I started to ask you a little while ago was, Great. This is an important issue for farmers. Why is it an important issue for those of us who aren't farmers?
Well, I think again, when stray voltage occurs, it's because there's some sort of a problem with the electrical system. Something's not connected correctly, or a connection has broken or become corroded. There are similar situations with any electrical system. So in your house, you know, there's a great deal of attention paid to the safety of the electrical system. And, you know, in a residence, we like to make sure that things are installed correctly and are maintained correctly. And, you know, we don't want voltages developing anywhere where people can touch them either. And so I would say recently there has been more attention paid on potential contact voltages for human exposures, and those, you know, both in residence but also particularly in public spaces like lamp poles and things like that. So there are investigative procedures and they're, you know, slightly different because of the environment, but it's also an issue with human exposures as well.
So when Jana Schleiss, our producer here, was prepping me for this, she talked to me about cows jumping over doorways.
Yes.
Which I have a great visual in my head, but why would cows jump over doorways?
Yeah, so we've been spending a lot of time on waters in our discussion, and for kind of reasons that they are important, but there are other places where cows can come into contact with a voltage a difference. And one of those is when a cow is moving into a building, out of a building, or between building sections, right? So the floor in most buildings has a metallic grid in it. It's reinforcing bar. And so there's an electrical sort of surface in one building and in another building. And if those are not connected, then you can actually develop what's called a step potential. So you get a voltage between the front hooves and the back hooves of the cows. So this is it's another type of exposure.
Right.
Same principles, but instead of muzzle to feet, now it's front hooves to rear hooves.
So they put the front hooves down and the rear hooves are on the other side, and there's a current that is going through them.
From front to rear hooves,
and
right.
So it just makes sense to not have your front and rear hooves on the ground at the same time.
Right. So jumping over that threshold is one way. It's an adaptation behavior. And, you know, it's much less common than the water exposure, just because it's less common to have that step potential develop than it is a muzzle to hoof exposure.
We've got a couple of calls here. Jim from Dane, welcome to the program.
How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking the call. It's more of a comment. I'm a practicing veterinarian, and this goes back to probably the mid to early 90s. So, unfortunately, I'm getting old enough. I've got stories now. Standing in a barn, treating a cow, and my fingers always crack in the winter. So I had, for some reason, I had my hand in the water bowl, and the other one, this was an old surge system, if you remember those, Doug. So they didn't have a pipeline at the time, and I touched that under the surge line with my other hand, and I can tell you there was potential across there. I told the guy what I found, and I said, I bet nobody's going to believe me. Had the power company come out, they found 9 volts. I think I had at least 2 of those while I was in bed.
Wow.
Across my 2 front hooves, I felt it as well. So yeah. It's a fitting spot for that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. We've also have Bunny from Bessemer. Bunny, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Go ahead. Give us your comment.
Okay, about in the 1960s, we're going back that far, in the state of Washington, a friend of mine worked for the U.S. for the state forestry department in the state of Washington, and he would explain to me how some organizations was studying wildlife under those, you know, thousands of miles of high tension lines through the forest and whatever. And the only thing I can remember for sure is that he said they were finding that bumblebees that were living underneath these lines, a lot of them were no longer able to reproduce, and they were studying other insects and other small animal life. And this is way back in the 60s.
So that's interesting. Doug has a very pensive look on his face right now. Is that possible that electrical currents can affect animals in terms of their sterility and things like that?
So just to be clear, the studies that have been done around transmission lines, high voltage power lines, that's really not stray voltage, right? So earlier in the show, we were talking about the difference between electric and magnetic fields and stray voltage. So stray voltage is something that's carried on a wire and the animal has to sort of come into contact with the electrical system to be affected by voltage. Electric and magnetic fields are transmitted through the air. So it's a very different electrical phenomenon. And there has also been a lot of research done on I'm most familiar with the research done on farm animals under transmission lines, and there have been a number of studies done on that. I'm not as familiar with the studies done on wildlife, although I know there have been those studies as well. And again, there are sort of rules and regulations about acceptable levels of electric and magnetic field exposures.
We are talking with Professor Doug Reinemann about stray voltage. He's been studying this issue for a few decades now. There's a lot of controversy here, Doug, about whether wind farms create more stray voltage. Now, I know a lot of people don't like wind farms. They don't like how they look, how they're changing the landscape, what have you. But just in terms of the electrical part of that, mm-hmm. Do wind farms create more stray voltage?
So if you think about a wind turbine, it's an electrical generator, or if you have a wind farm, you have a whole bunch of electrical generators. So fundamentally, there's no difference. It's a way of generating electricity. So you know, there's no fundamental difference in whether it's a wind farm or a diesel engine generator or a electric power plant, right? So the difference really comes down to how those wind systems are connected into the electrical system. Most of the big systems are connected into the transmission system, so they're not really connected to the farm. They're connected to the high voltage power lines, which are sort of like the super highways of electricity. There's also small electric generators that might be owned by a farmer, and that has a very different electrical connection. That is actually connected directly into the farm's electrical system and the local distribution system. So depending on the type of the turbine, and you know, it depends on how it's connected. And again, there are rules and regulations, and I think the short answer is if things are installed properly, they're not going to create a problem.
Okay, so in the next 30 seconds or so, tell me where farmers can go if they want more information on stray voltage.
Yeah, so the first stop would be your electric utility. So if you have any concerns, call your electric company, have them come out and do a test. Second stop would be there's actually the Department of Ag runs a rural electric power services. They can call the Department of Ag. Website mrec.org has a lot of information as well.
And we will have that on our website, wpr.org. Doug Reinemann is a professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also a member of the Midwest Rural Energy Council, and he is an expert on stray voltage. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Doug.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.